Good evening again. I have seen most of you before this weekend, and it's very nice to see you again. I feel like I'm in this community for a time. And I would like to introduce for the first time the person who drove me here. She's from Crystal Springs Sangha in Burlingame, and her name is Carol Bomberger. She's been my assistant, and many of you who came for Dokusan have met her. And her kindness and attention to my care has been very important to me. So I've been talking. Saturday I talked about working people samadhi, and I talked about it from the point of view of the three doors of liberation: emptiness, signlessness, and aimlessness. I talked about those three practices quite a bit on Saturday, and we actually did some of them experientially. We did those three experientially, along with some others, but tonight I'd like to talk about it from a different point of view, maybe a Zen point of view tonight. That is Abhidharma, that point of view that we talked about on Saturday. The Abhidharma is much older than Zen. Theravada is associated with Theravada Buddhism. But Zen, much later, has a different point of view, and it's the point of view of the Bodhisattva ideal. So I'd like to talk about working people's samadhi from that point of view this evening. So first of all, why this topic of working people's samadhi at all? You know, why am I interested in it? And I am interested in it. I've been talking about it, gave a practice period about it late last year. So why am I interested in it? Well, because I'm very interested in this bold American experiment that we're doing, which has never been done before, which is working in the world, raising children, and practicing. And if there's anything to this, if there's anything to it, our generation won't answer this. Generations hence will say whether it was successful or not, whether we will produce practitioners and teachers in this generation that continue this practice. So does it really help to liberate people from their suffering? Can you be liberated from your suffering if you're working and raising children and worrying about the mortgage? Can you do this? So this American experiment that we're all a part of will help answer that question. This is fascinating to me. I love to place us in a context, an historical context. It's inspiring to me. But what we're doing, at the same time that I'm saying it hasn't been done before, what we're doing is actually the logical extension of Chan, of Zen in China, when Zen got to China and met Taoism. It changed Buddhism enormously. It changed Theravada Buddhism to got it out of the list of things, 108 this, 12 this, 4 this, got it out of the intellect and into the body. Very important to the to Taoism, the body. And so they shifted, the practice shifted from purification of the three poisons, shifted from concern with purification to skillful means. What are we actually doing? What is our actual activity? So it's switched from study, from refining intellect and studying the states of mind very closely, to work. What is in your mind during work? What is your body doing doing during work. So Zen, as you know, is very much chopping wood, carrying water. That's why it shifts to the body, and the body's activity is a result of contact with Taoism in China. But the ancients didn't exactly return to the marketplace like we do. They were monks. Monks tending their fields around their monasteries, living a very different life than we do. They worked monastic fields in silence and lived a simple life as monks. They did not worry about their kids getting into a particular nursery school. They did not worry about their cars breaking down because they couldn't afford to fix them, that kind of thing. They did not worry about something arriving in the mail, you know, saying there was a glitch in the computer and now you owe $10,000. So they didn't have to worry about that kind of thing. We do. Our lives are very complex, layered and layered and layered, because of our connections with the world that we live in. Now, there were a few exceptions. There were so few exceptions that they were very exceptional. There were lay people that practiced. Layman Pang, for instance, and his wife and daughter. The Momalakirti Sutra is all about a layman who practiced, who got the better of Shariputra and Ananda and all the other monks by lying in a sick bed and receiving them one by one. That's what that sutra is about. It's a very, if you practice as a lay person, it's a very inspiring sutra, short and full of humor and gotcha stuff, exposing the stifling arrogance of the monastic community. But those were definitely exceptions. So there are always, in traditional societies, there's always been a division between monks and lay people and what their practice is, and between men and women and what their practice is, always in traditional society. But here in America, we're blurring everything. The roles of women, monks, and lay people. And we're bringing in all kinds of people who were never, could never have imagined that they could practice before. People with disabilities, people in jail, people in homeless people, people on the street, mothers, you know, all kinds of people are practicing who it was never imagined. When I first started teaching handicapped people, in wheelchairs, practice many years ago, maybe it's 20 years by now. One woman was in tears and said, I never imagined that in this lifetime I would ever be able to sit meditation. So as you all know, you know, Zen centers have gradually accommodated people in chairs, people who have to lie down because of physical difficulties, etc. So this is part of American practice. This doesn't happen other places. And our blurring of men and women, I mean, that's unheard of, or was unheard of. So we're just jumping in the deep end of the pool and seeing what it feels like. I mean, that's part of what's admirable about our American spirit. You know, we just come, don't know a thing, just come sit on a cushion and go from there. So, as I said, there always were exceptions to these stratifications. Bodhidharma had four Dharma heirs, and one of them was a woman. Dogen expressly invited women to practice in his Zendo. So those were, I mean, it's impossible for us to know the kind of revolutionary and radical thinking that entails for a teacher, a great teacher, renowned teacher, to invite women to practice. So what is different about the samadhi of working people from that of the ancients who formulated monastic practice? What is it? We have to get to the essence and make sure that we're practicing the essence here and not leaving out what's important. So I've thought about it, and this is what is essential to my mind. First of all, the focus of practice will always be, forever will be, Buddha's original insight, his original understanding of interconnection. That's the original insight under the Bo tree, which was tested as he sat there. But that insight of interconnectedness, that we're all connected to each other, that we're all one, and it's a certain state of mind that separates us, actually, or a certain point of view that separates us. But at the same time, there's the point of view that sees us as one. So this is the insight you have when you're able to penetrate self, when you're able to penetrate self and the suffering it engenders. Everything else that we call Buddhism grows out of this basic insight. And the great thing about Buddhism, as I've said before, the thing I love about Buddhism is it doesn't ask us to believe what Buddha saw, what Buddha understood. It asks us to have the same experience. It asks us to recreate that insight for ourselves. Why else should we believe any of this stuff? Why else should we bow to an altar, light incense? It doesn't make any sense unless you yourself understand your bowing as an expression of your own insight. So this is not dogma I'm talking about here. This is available to you. So that insight is part of the essence that we must continue to the generations behind us. And also, another essential that's always been part of Buddhist practice is a simple life. A simple life, always including manual physical labor, the upkeep of the body, mind, and one's living space. Now, as I said, and as obvious to you, we live very complex lives now. But we can also have a simple life by keeping sight of and keeping focus on the basics of life. Living and dying, our immediate surrounding, and the care of the physical space and the people in our immediate surrounding. And by taking care of that ourselves with our own bodies. When I first started to work work in the world after working for Zen Center for 15 years, because I suddenly jumped out of a world in which simple physical labor was very much valued into a world of conceptual. Let's see, what did I first do? I can hardly remember what I did. I think it was a legal secretary or something. I can't remember. Anyway, I remember I no longer had time to clean my own house with my family. We always cleaned our house together, my husband and my child. On Saturdays, we would go to the lecture at Zen Center, come home and clean the house. That was just part of what we did. But now there were all these errands and dry cleaning to pick up. Who knew about dry cleaning before? And so we hired someone to clean our house. And I remember the loss that I felt about that. I would just come home and all my little chashkas would be dusted without my participation. Now there's an upside to this. I don't mean it's totally negative, but that connection is broken. That connection is broken. And I, of course, my hours didn't permit me anymore to cook. You know, I used to take my turn cooking at Zen Center and we would eat there. anyway, that was interesting to me. So, but you can, I mean, since it didn't take so long before I could figure out how to get reconnected. So, this simple physical approach to your surroundings and the things you do, I started noticing at work, walking to the Xerox machine, you know, working on the computer, you know, that kind of thing. So I started noticing the simple physical stuff that I did at work and got into that simple stuff. So I was the only secretary that I know of who loved to make coffee for people, because that was more of the simple manipulating objects. So, let's see, what the mind focus on. Let's see, focus. So it requires a focus, finding the physical, the simple stuff, the physical stuff. And then the third thing is, wherever we practice, in the marketplace or in retreat, the most important practice is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the king of practice. So it was for the ancients, and it is for us. So again, what most people do with simple physical labor is think of something else while they're doing it, because they have the idea that it's boring, you know, doing the dishes, running the vacuum cleaner, instead of focusing your mind on your movements or the space you're cleaning, the dishes you're washing. You think of some fantasy or even worse, what you have to do the next day. And this is going out of what you're doing. You're kind of wasting the simple physical labor that could be grounding you and could be actually a refuge from your complex life when you do this. So mindfulness is very important. And I have a student at Zen Center, my favorite example of this, who was again and again and again every day assigned by the work leader to wash the windows in the Buddha hall. And so she washed, you know, they're all small panes, and there are lots of them. So finally she complained to me. She said, I have to leave Zen Center and go because I want to work in a homeless shelter. This is ridiculous that I can't be helping people, and I'm instead washing the same windows that I got clean a week ago, and I'm just doing busy work, she complained to me. And I said, well, you know, I don't think you'll be much help on the street until you find the mind that doesn't see this as busy work. Until you find the mind that can do this with complete absorption again and again. Otherwise, you'll go out on the street, you'll expect people to be grateful to you for what you do, you won't be able to focus on the activity itself, you'll look at them and, hey, thank me, I'm helping you. You know, it's not enough to want to help. It's not enough to want to help. You have to have some skills in your focus. So, okay, she went back to doing the windows. This is an example of what I'm talking about. Find the mind that is completely absorbed in this simple task. Find it. It's in here somewhere. Keep looking. It's not immediately available. It's in here somewhere. So, the fourth thing that I think is the essence of the ancients' practice that we still can do is the ancients admired the ideal of the bodhisattva as the pinnacle of practice, as a personification of the middle way, the person who's in the world but not of the world, the person who's not seduced by the world's fascinations and sense pleasures, the person who sits solidly in emptiness but is not caught by emptiness, not seduced by bliss states. So I'd like to quote some commentary for the Jewel Mir Samadhi. The Jewel Mir Samadhi, I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, it's a poem that's based on the five ranks of a bodhisattva, five different stages, if you can parse apart, which you can, you know, a state of mind. It's parsing into five different categories, the enlightened stage of a bodhisattva, five different points of view of the enlightenment of a bodhisattva. And it's particularly interesting to me because of the admiration of the bodhisattva ideal. So this is the bodhisattva who comes back from emptiness, from total bliss, to sit in the dusty marketplace with dirty hands. This is a quote from the commentary on the Jewel Mir Samadhi. The bodhisattva, the person who comes back willingly from their bliss to sit in the dusty marketplace with dirty hands. So what is the dusty marketplace with dirty hands? We know it well. We know it well. So the commentary says, is this an ordinary man? Is he a sage? The evil ones and the heretics cannot discern him. In other words, they can't tell this bodhisattva from anybody else. So the evil ones can't find him to corrupt him, because they can't tell the difference between him and anybody else sitting in the dusty marketplace. Even the Buddhas and the ancestors cannot lay their hands on it, because there's not even the slightest whiff of attainment. So the Buddhas and the Buddhas and the ancestors can't corrupt him either by, say, putting their arm around him and say, welcome to the club. They can't do that. They can't discern him from anybody else who's sitting in the dusty marketplace with dirty hands. So this is the most admired state of mind in Zen, a person who cannot be seduced by the sense pleasures of the world or by the attainment of enlightenment. It's all the same to him. So what we are being asked to do, if we practice in the world, is to create a samadhi of focusing on emptiness while living in the form world, while being solidly in the form world, the marketplace, returning to the dust of the world from our feet in nirvana. This is considered the deepest samadhi of all. And this is the middle way, the combination, or the combination of paradoxes. So, what time should I stop talking, Brian?
20 more minutes.
20 more minutes? Oh, okay. That's good.
Okay.
Well, I do want to ask questions, so that should be at 8:30. Okay, good. Thanks. Okay. So, practicing Zen, or practicing meditation, is counter. You have to understand how difficult this is. If you have trouble practicing, there's very good reasons for it. Because it's counter to four very predominant human impulses. One is escaping from ourselves. You know, we like to think the best of ourselves. It's not possible to observe ourselves closely and think the best of ourselves. It's not possible. You'll have to let go of something or another. And most people let go of closely observing themselves. They start glossing over things. They start numbing over things. In order to maintain a high opinion of oneself, this is necessary. requires a great deal of stability to be able to look at yourself, to be able to live with yourself. I mean, I feel so sorry for myself that I have to live with myself. And I feel very sorry for my students who also have to live with me. And I feel the most sorry for my husband, except that he regularly complains about it, so he at least gets to express himself. So, but Zen asks us, instead of, you know, going to a movie or something when we start to get the creeping feeling that we're really disgusting human beings, or smoking a little dope, Zen asks us to come back. Stay here. Stay and look. Stay and look. How many people did you hurt today? It asks you to know. Doesn't ask you to go on a Catholic guilt trip about it. There's no such thing as crying over spilled milk in Zen. It's happened, it's there, you look at it, you go on and hurt the next person. You just go on hurting. 100,000 regrets. That's from the Gateless Barrier. Wu Min's verse about the fox koan. 100,000 regrets. That's the life of a bodhisattva. That's the life of someone who observes themselves closely. So it's counter to that tendency to look away, our practices. So if you have trouble with this, so does everybody else. It's heroic to do otherwise. The only thing that helps us at all is the stability that we glean from our meditation practice and the support of a sangha. Your sangha already knows all these disgusting things about you. You're the last to know. And if you will accept their support and take their kindness toward you as an indication that they don't consider these disgusting things, you know, deal breakers, it's comforting. You know, when I walk into Zen Center, still after all these years, people, hello darling, hello, and I think these people know me so well for 30 years and they still say hello. I take such comfort in that, and you can too. So another predominant human impulse that I think practicing is counter to is our tendency to create a secure little cocoon for ourselves and those we love. You know, the world is so terrible, we hold it out and we'll just make sure that this area, you know, our house and our backyard is pure. So, and then the third thing is doing things to get something done, to be accomplished. You know, that's a tendency and that's highly reinforced and valued in our culture right now. But it is very counterproductive to the bodhisattva path, to accomplish things, to have your eye on the end result of your activity rather than your activity. And then having a single identity or a single opinion that will be generalized over many different situations. You know, we tend to do that because it's convenient to have like a policy that we apply to all different, you know, situations, an ethical stance that we take everywhere without taking the situation into account or the people that we're dealing with into account. And that's, you know, we do that for convenience, to keep the things in order rather than having to be awake to each situation. That takes a lot of energy. But it's what our practice requires from us, that we are awake. Awake for the situation, awake and asking ourselves, in this situation, what is the most important thing? And it's almost never our opinion. Our opinion from 10 years ago. It almost never is that. So if you have trouble practicing being alive and genuine, don't give up. I know it's hard. It's very hard. I've been practicing 35 years or something, and I still find it almost impossible. But it's very energetic to keep trying. It gives your life meaning and gives your life inspiration to keep trying. So again, you can't look at the results. I mean, I would hate to add up all my successes, you know, in which I handled the situation with great flair. Everybody was happy and I was happy. This almost never happens. And if you focus on that, the results, you're dead in the water. You have to keep trying. Keep developing your heart. Keep developing your fearlessness. And you have to keep developing your ability to look at things straight on without flowers and lace and nice poetry and sayings and fluff, to just look straight on. So, practicing the Bodhisattva path is very important in dealing with these four difficulties that I've just mentioned, because it grounds our values. Having a meditation practice does ground our values, makes them basic facts about our lives. It encourages our we thinking, you know, instead of closing us up in our little houses and nuclear families. And I do believe that this we thinking, being able to get out of our own particular cubicle, is necessary for the world right now. And you all know this, I don't have to belabor this point. You know, the more we can include each other and people of different points of view in our we, you know, that's really helpful for us all. So Dogen never forgot the lessons he learned from the Zen cook in China. You know his famous writing, Instructions to the Cook, Instructions to the Tendo. It was the Zen cook's duty, he wrote, to make the best and most sumptuous meal possible out of whatever ingredients were available, even if he had only rice and water. The Zen cook used what he had rather than complaining or making excuses about what he didn't have. At every moment, we simply take the ingredients at hand and make the best meal that we possibly can. It doesn't matter how much or how little we have. We work with what we've got. If we're not very bright, well, we work with what we do have, a big heart. You know, maybe we have trouble learning the form or learning which bell to hit when. We practice with our heart. My tea teacher, I love tea, Japanese tea ceremony, and I practiced it at Green Gulch Farm during the worst period of my life. I was just coming down with rheumatoid arthritis. My husband and I were breaking up, and he was taking our child with him. He was leaving Green Gulch. And I was so depressed, and that ceremony is just, it's so transporting in its beauty. And I used to just sit there and watch my tea teacher, Okamura Sensei, begin each lesson with her demonstration. And she was, you know, in Japan, a master at this, a master, which was why Baker Roshi, who found her in a monastery, brought her over. She was an aristocrat, and she had been, her husband had kicked her out of their home because she was secretly teaching tea, which an aristocrat is not allowed to do. So you know, kicked her out. She took refuge in a Buddhist monastery, and that's where Baker Roshi found her and brought her to the States. Anyway, she used to just tisk, you know. Here she was, this proud woman, and we were all barbarians. I mean, she had to make some rules for us, which I'm sure she never had to make in Japan. She said that we had to have clean fingernails. She said we couldn't come to class with a runny nose. We had to have clean clothes. So she actually had to tell us to do this. In fact, I was her attendant for a time, and she must have pulled this with every new attendant she had. But she handed me her kimono, one of her kimonos. She always dressed traditionally, and said, "Here, please wash this." And the way you wash it is you take it apart, and then you sew, wash each piece, and then you sew it back together. And I said, "Nakamura Sensei, you're in America now. Forget it." So what was it? Why did I bring her up? Oh, you know, I love tea ceremonies so much, but you know, I just never could get it. First of all, I don't have a graceful body. I used to take dance when I was a pre-adolescent and in my early adolescence because I loved dance so much, but I always was my teachers, you know. I mean, my teachers never even wanted to put me in the recital. You know, I just don't get it, whatever it is. And the same with tea ceremony. I couldn't do the sequence right. I couldn't. But she used me as an example to the other students often and said, "Not good tea, but great heart." Because I loved it so. And each time I tried it, I did not start with the attitude of "I'm terrible." I thought, "This time I'll break through." The thousandth time that I practiced tea, I would say, this time I'm going to break through. Now, I never did, but this engenders great heart, which she admires. So this is a Zen cook's duty, to work with what you have. I did not have talent, but I do have heart. So it's about 8:30. Let's see, can I tell you anything else? Well, I wanted to actually talk about creating samadhi. So it seems like I should do that. So there are various problems we have, blah, blah. And so I want to finish this talk by talking a little about creating and maintaining a samadhi, a state of concentration. As I explained on Saturday, this is a very intense state of concentration which you build by making little decisions all the time. You're always making decisions in favor of practicing the samadhi. Not that you can't, you know, cut out for a while, but that does break up your ability to get deeper and deeper and deeper. But you can always start again. You can always start again and build this focus until it's the underpinning of your life. Until you don't even have to make those decisions anymore because your body makes them for you. It always decides to return to the focus. And if your focus is four bodhisattva vows, saving all sentient beings, admitting delusion, I forget how that goes, accepting delusion or not having delusion, dealing with delusion in some helpful way, entering the Dharma gates and embodying Buddha's way. If you decide to make a samadhi of those four vows, you will be constantly asking, well, is this a choice point? Well, clearly saving all sentient beings, however you interpret that, is connecting, is making some connection. So if your habit is to pull away at some point and judge a person, and this is the habit of many, 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 many people, maybe 100% of us do this. At some point you pull away from a friend or a coworker or a relative and judge them. They've offended you in some way. Maybe you don't even know what they did really, because the offense is so ingrained in you, you don't even know it's a value to question, or an opinion to question. You pull away and you judge. So if you can catch yourself doing this, you can make a choice about it. Well, maybe I should stay in here with this person, even though I've judged them. Maybe I should stay in here and, you know, try to work this out. Or stay connected. Just noticing that this is the product of your opinion can help. So this is what I mean about creating and maintaining a samadhi. Nothing happens to you, nothing, without your relating it to, in this case, I'm talking about the four bodhisattva vows. So, samadhi is staying focused on mindfulness and awareness, asking what's the most important thing in the situation. The reason that question is so important is because it keeps you asking what are my deepest values? You go to work, it's quite possible to completely be swept along by the ethic of your workplace, which is probably speed and acquisition. You've heard me say this many times. Maybe your workplace is different, but there's some workplace culture that will sweep you along. If you have different values than that, you have to be constantly saying, what is the most important thing to me in this situation? So you can decide to honor the samadhi that you're trying to create, assert your values, figure out how to make this playing field very wide for yourself. It's constantly asking that question in every situation that keeps you alert and keeps you grounded in your own values. So this is continuous practice, embedding one's life in the Buddha Dharma, relating everything that happens, all relationships in the Buddha Dharma. This means there are no more misfortunes. It's all grist for the practice mill. This is what taking refuge in Dharma is. There are no more misfortunes. You do not perceive misfortunes after you take refuge in the Dharma, because it's all up for grabs. It's all learning. It's all practice after that. All practice. No more misfortunes. It's all practice. That's what taking refuge in Dharma is. So, let's see. So maintaining samadhi in a hostile environment, I actually have talked about this quite a bit over the last couple of days. Maybe I don't have to spend so much time about it. You have to find your personal middle way, being the place where your energy is greatest. Where is the place in the interaction with the culture, with your coworkers, with your relatives, with your children, with your mate? Where is your energy highest? If you completely take your coworker's point of view, just if you capitulate to it, just keep peace, is your energy high? I don't think so. If you demand that everybody listen to you and take your point of view, I don't think so. I think that the energy is highest when you find your personal middle way, a little closer to you, a little closer to them, that you bring yourself into every formulation. A fellow asked a question last night about how to interact with vampires. He said people who, you know, want everything from you, they slurp up your energy. And so I was suggesting that not only with them, but in all your interactions, you find the place where you can enter with your own heart, your own opinions, your own values. And I see it as, you know, when you were a kid and two girls were skipping rope, you know, and you're supposed to go into the double rope at a certain time. It's just like that. When do you slip in there and engage? It's that kind of skill. There's a right time, a right way. And don't wait for that. If you don't see it that way, just go in anyway, because that's how you learn. Mistake after mistake, regret after regret. So I think seeing your behavior as inevitably political is very helpful. I've talked about this before. I'm not going to go into it a lot. Again, just know that what you do reverberates through the universe. If you can just see everything, if you like to think that way, if you like to think of yourself as relevant, everything you do is political. It's ultimately political. You may influence people you have no idea about. I know that if you let someone in traffic, they will probably let someone else in traffic. You know, you can actually make, I mean, this is an unkind world right now, and you should take a stand in kindness that way. So, okay, let's forget that one. Oh no, that's a good one, that's good. So Shakyamuni said, when I'm enlightened, all beings are enlightened. He said that under the Bodhi tree. I got enlightened. All beings are enlightened. So what does this mean? I think it means seeing the nobility of other lives as well as your own, listening deeply, hearing the cries of a person's heart. If you look at a person superficially, you have much to criticize about them. Why did they do that? That is really stupid. Why are they acting so self-destructively? And you look at a person superficially and don't give them the benefit of the doubt. You judge. You don't understand their motivation. But looking deeply, we see the reason for people's mistakes. We see the reason for people's mistakes. Why do people believe that people shouldn't have abortions? Why do they believe that? Are they insane? Possibly a couple people are. But not everybody who has that opinion is insane. Why would another human being believe that? You're capable of extending that courtesy and trying to figure it out, of understanding it. You don't have to change your opinion, but you should understand someone else's. And mental flexibility. You know, that's too big a topic. I'll stop with that one. Next is the place of appreciating the place of suffering in our lives. Suffering can be part of creating your samadhi. You should understand the proper role of suffering. It's to feed the spirit. You know, sometimes people will say to me little New Age quotes like, be happy all the time or something. I can't remember what they are, but, oh, this is the beginning of the rest of your life, or make today the happiest day of your life. I hate that. Because, I mean, it's one part of it, but suffering, you can trust suffering. You know, it's the other part of it. To say that, it's so unbalanced, you know, suffering is so inspiring, you know, and it's so trustworthy. And it's so, this is not martyrdom to accept suffering, but accepting the place that suffering has in our lives. The other shore is not the elimination of suffering in the world, not going to a different world, but seeing this world from a different point of view. The Bodhisattva does not say, this world is terrible, let me help you escape from it, but says instead, come look at it this way and you will have a quite different and more satisfying experience. And that's what suffering does for us. Makes our playing field very wide. Okay. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we want in life? What do we want our life to be about? So forget, as I said, the day before, you forget comfort and ease. This is hopelessness to expect comfort and ease to always be with you. So forget security, you'll never be secure enough. Most of us practice to be happy, to live life to the fullest. But the Dhammapada, Theravada Buddhism again, states that nothing of the world can make us happy. No sense pleasure or precious object or esteem or accomplishment can make us happy. In fact, when you get all those things, which you should, I mean, that is enrichment. If they do enrich our lives, all those things, esteem and accomplishment, and sense pleasures. Anybody who's ever gotten a massage can attest to that. They do enrich our lives, but they're not refuges. They actually can increase our suffering tremendously when they disappear. So my own experience is that the only reliable source of happiness is service to others. When the quantity of suffering in the world decreases, our own suffering decreases. Also, this is how the world works. You know, this kind of energy moves through us, moves through everyone else. Dana Paramita, keep it flowing. So are there any questions or comments about this topic? Yes, Oscar.
The other day you said, and I think you touched on today too, something, if I understand it, to the effect that through making decisions to strengthen our practice, to deepen our practice and strengthen our samadhi, we even develop new neural pathways or restructure the way we work. There.
Doing that develops neural pathways, right?
And you said something about that. And then over time, this counteracts the statistical weight of constantly doing what habitually might.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do you discern?
Well, please share it with us.
The question is, how do you discern when to make a choice one way or the other? Mm-hmm. And I guess the answer is to decide what the most important thing is at that point.
Mm-hmm. And if you choose wrong at that particular moment, you'll know it, and that adds to your information. So part of what happens, I think, over time is that you feel less shame about making mistakes. You see your life as a kind of experiment, and your attitude becomes more curious rather than moral. I think the moral realm is not so helpful in practice. I think the investigative realm or the curious realm is extremely helpful. To be curious, what happens if I do this? rather than I'm a terrible person for even thinking of this, or I'm a virtuous person for even thinking of this.
Thought of dual mirror samadhi is a nemesis for me. So I would love to read a good commentary on it if you can direct me to one.
Well, I don't have it at my fingertips, but look online. The lines I read you, I got online. So I just typed in dual mirror samadhi. I might have put in dual ornament. Anyway, you'll find it. Yes.
I can piggyback on Oscar's question about decisions and decision making, and what I hear you saying is obvious. I mean, everything I do is habit and decision is more conscious. And as I'm beginning to shift from this habit, I'm a classroom teacher, and I'm doing more centering. Like, the days that I'm really centered meditating, the days that I don't, I notice difference. But are there other techniques? We did a little bit of the breath work where I was paying attention to my breath while I was speaking. I was wondering if there are any other techniques so that can help, so that my decision making is coming from that more centered place. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Any mindfulness practice will do that. The thing is choosing a mindfulness practice that you'll actually do, that you enjoy. Like the signlessness practice we did on Saturday is one that people often enjoy, going around without labeling things. And if you do that deeply, in other words, for a long time, and see where it leads, that actually is very helpful. Not jump around among practices. So find a practice that you like and stick with it for a while. Yes, Linda.
Can you talk a little bit about creating a cocoon?
Yes.
I do that a lot.
The world is terrible, so you withdraw?
No, I don't think the world is terrible at all. But it's always important for me to have a space. It can be small, very simple, but a space that I feel safe and comfortable in. And isn't that really a hindrance, as long as I'm very aware that any kind of security I get out of that is an illusion?
Well, I'm not sure. The reason I said you see the world as terrible and so you withdraw, I wasn't sure that you were doing what I was describing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm describing a kind of helpless attitude in which you can't do anything about the world. So you withdraw to a space that you can control, your own home, and let the world go to hell. You at least have some ease and comfort and security here.
Well, I guess there's an element of that, but it's for recharging. It's not the complete withdrawal.
It's not a stance, right?
Yeah.
No, I don't think you're doing what I'm talking about.
So when you say I want to save all beings, as soon as I hear that, I'm like, that's a ridiculous idea. It's an impossibility.
Yes, it is.
And so I withdraw. I throw my hands up in there and go, that's insanity. That's like trying to rake all the leaves in Sacramento. So I withdraw from that. Can I say something else?
Well, you're seeing the forest instead of the trees. So try to save sentient beings one at a time. Start with yourself. What do you need? What do you need to be a generous, kind, and compassionate person? That's a great place to start. What makes you generous and compassionate? What do you have to have in your life to make you that way? It's a good place to start. Then you can take your next door neighbor or somebody like that, coworker. You can do your neighborhood. Or your sangha. Will you start with yourself, will you promise?
Well, I should investigate that because I'd like to know what floats my boat. I mean, there's so many things. It's like,
so should I stop?
Can you walk down the path? How would you walk down the path if your intention was to save all beings? Can you walk down the path if with that intention? And how would that affect your walking down the path? I mean, literally, like walking down the path.
One more question? Yes.
Pretty easy, but what's the name of the sutra you mentioned by the first comment or the layman?
Oh, of the Malakirti. V-I-M-A-L. You've heard of it.
Yes.
That was the name of the gentleman who was a layperson. Okay, thank you very much.